Our topic today is current immigration issues, and there are a whole bunch of them. It's not just Dreamers. It's a question of legal immigration as well as illegal immigration. And we are fortunate to have two very knowledgeable speakers who come from different perspectives. First, Kathleen Farrell. Kathleen is the Director of Communications for the National Immigration Forum. The National Immigration Forum is a network of faith, law enforcement, business, and veterans that seeks to help new arrivals attain the opportunities, skills, and status to reach their full potential. Our other presenter is Matt O'Brien, who is the Research Director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. The Federation, also known by its acronym FAIR, works for immigration policies that include better border management, lower levels of overall immigration, and a greater focus on highly skilled immigrants. Have you decided who's going to speak first?
Ladies first.
Okay, Kathleen. Come up and take the podium, Kathleen.
Yes, Matt very graciously allowed me to speak first, so... So good afternoon, and thank you all for the invitation to come and speak and the opportunity to visit your lovely community. I was telling folks over lunch that Charlottesville has long been on my list to visit, so I came in last night. I only got a chance to walk around town for a while, but I will be back. Most of all, I want to thank you for your interest in this topic. So the United States is a nation of immigrants, and immigration has made us strong, and it's made us vibrant and innovative, entrepreneurial, competitive, and safe. We might disagree on the levels of immigration we need at a given time, but it has been true since the founding of our country that we have greatly benefited from immigrants and immigration and continue to do so. I work for the National Immigration Forum, an organization that advocates for the value that immigrants and immigration bring to the nation. That also means we advocate for border security, we support safe communities and immigration policies that help the American worker and their families, among other policy initiatives. We also advocate for policy fixes that ensure that immigrants contribute to this country to their fullest potential. And by that I mean we advocate for a range of integration issues, such as naturalization or becoming a citizen, learning or improving English language skills, and improving workforce skills, among many other things. Not a day goes by that immigration isn't in the news. In part, that is because then-candidate Donald Trump made it a centerpiece of his campaign when he announced he was running for president 3 years ago. And it's also in the news because immigration touches many aspects of our daily lives, such as the economy, national security, and culture. We've heard for many years about undocumented immigrants, border security, sanctuary cities, the cost-benefit of immigrants to our country. Lately, we've heard a lot about family separation at the southern border, asylum and the vetting of refugees, a border wall with Mexico, and reducing levels of legal immigration. We have an opportunity to address all these issues, and I would urge you to keep in mind as we do so that we are a nation of laws and a nation of grace. By that I mean that we respect the rule of law and that we are compassionate and uphold our long-cherished values in the writing and application of laws and policies. Matt O'Brien and I have been asked to talk to you today about a very broad range of issues, and the truth is some of them are so complex that we would be here for the rest of the day or maybe even into tomorrow sorting through just the basic outlines of many of them. So I'd like to use my time with you to address some of the most topical issues and then address other specific issues you might have during the question period. I will talk about the border. I recently, within the last 3 weeks, visited both our northern and southern borders, the undocumented and sanctuary cities. I look at this issue not just as an advocate, but also as an immigrant myself, who has benefited greatly from the generosity of this country. I also like to believe that I have contributed through my hard work and through raising two daughters who deeply love this country, as do I. If you read my bio, you will see that I am a native of Montreal, Canada. But what my bio doesn't say is that on March 13th of this year, I became a citizen of the United States of America. That is perhaps my proudest accomplishment to date. Don't tell my daughters. No matter who you are or what your personal story is, immigration touches you in one way or another. And I would invite you to reflect on how this is so, perhaps through your parents, grandparents, or even earlier generations. Perhaps you have close friends, colleagues, or even people in your sphere who have come from another country to make better lives for themselves here. The gentleman who drove me from my hotel in a taxi this afternoon is a refugee from Togo who came here in 2000. You just turn around and you will meet an immigrant. There are significant immigrant communities in all 50 states of the Union. We could boil down the discussion to whether immigrants are givers or takers, and I would argue in the vast majority of cases, immigrants fall on the positive side of the ledger. Have they changed our country and culture? Yes, of course they have. Otherwise, pizza, pho, curry wouldn't be typical parts of the American diet, along with many other cultural contributions, innovations that are too great to enumerate. Have they changed our values as a nation? No, they have in fact embraced them. This is the point of view you'll be hearing from me today. But you must also keep in mind that I am as deeply committed as any native-born American to living in a safe, prosperous, and compassionate America, and I want to leave this world better than I found it. So let's talk about borders. There's universal concern about protecting our borders, as there should be. A sovereign nation has a right to determine who enters its country, how long they should be allowed to stay, and under what conditions. We support policies that promote safety and security along the border, as well as those that facilitate trade, tourism, and the economic health of the United States. A 21st century immigration system that promotes safety and security, benefits American workers and our economy, and provides earned legalization for otherwise law-abiding undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. would have the most significant impact in promoting security at our borders. We must choose policies that keep us safe while staying true to our principles as a nation of immigrants. And we believe in a common sense, humane solution that boosts security while protecting economic innovation. The Southwest border has more resources than ever, which includes a mix of personnel, technology, physical, and natural barriers. America's Southwest border has never been more secure. The U.S. has built nearly 700 miles of physical barriers along the Southwest border, with the rugged terrain and the Rio Grande acting as natural barriers in other areas. To complement these physical barriers, the Border Patrol has stationed 16,605 agents in the Southwest border in fiscal year 2017, so nearly double the number compared to fiscal year 2000. Between 2000 and 2017, Congress increased Border Patrol's budget approximately 380%, from about $1 billion to nearly $3.8 billion. At the same time, the average annual number of apprehensions made by each Border Patrol agent dropped from 191 in 2000 to 18 in 2017, under 2 apprehensions per month. The most recent data available shows each Border Patrol agent along the Southwest border apprehended on average about 2.3 migrants in April 2018, so what, 2 months ago, a small increase above 2017, but far below levels in the year 2000. Moving forward, Congress should carefully determine which uses of American taxpayers' funds are most appropriate. We support building physical barriers along the Southwest border, where the Department of Homeland Security, with the input of border security experts, local communities, and border residents, determines it's appropriate. We also encourage Congress to invest on expanding the use of technology along the border, which Customs and Border Protection, CBP, already relies on and often serves as a better force multiplier than a fence. The National Immigration Forum believes that investing in additional Border Patrol agents is not the most appropriate use of American taxpayer funds. Given the decline in the average number of apprehensions per Border Patrol agent over the last 15 years, as well as the agency's struggle to hire an additional 1,933, so another 2,000 agents, positions with funds already obligated by Congress in 2017, we believe that border security funding is best applied elsewhere, specifically at ports of entry. Congress should invest in the CBP Office of Field Operations, which oversees the flow of commerce and immigrants at all 328 ports of entry. CBP found in 2014 that adding a single officer from the Office of Field Operations to a port of entry would result in annual benefits of $2 million, a $2 million increase in our country's gross domestic product, $640,000 saved in opportunity costs, and 33 jobs added to the economy because it would help speed the flow of commerce. Investments in CBP's Office of Field Operations also help curtail major drug traffickers, with CBP statistics showing that 81% of hard drugs caught along the border between 2012 and 2016 were caught at ports of entry, 81%. Yet, the Office of Field Operations currently has a staffing shortage of at least 3,811 officers, representing a vulnerability in our country's border security. Investments to increase personnel levels at ports of entry would help better manage the flow of commerce and increase public safety, particularly amidst the opioid epidemic. Another investment to ensure safety at our borders is to fund a federal program to eradicate the invasive and non-native carrizo cane and salt cedar plants along the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. This effort would provide the Border Patrol with greater visibility and access to the Rio Grande. Finally, we encourage Congress to invest in funds to implement the use of body-worn camera technology at CBP. The evidence indicates that body-worn cameras lead to 88% fewer complaints against officers and fewer assaults, creating a win-win solution for the public and law enforcement. It is indisputable that the Southwest border has never had as many resources as it does today. The data suggests that it has never been more secure. We support continued investment in thoughtful and effective border security policies that increase safety and facilitate trade while improving border management. The number of apprehensions along the Southwest border between ports of entry has dropped from an all-time high of 1.6 million apprehensions in 2000 to fewer than 304,000 in 2016. This represents an 81% decrease and is the lowest number of apprehensions since 1971, more than 40 years ago. Between 2016 and 2017, border apprehensions fell about 25%, from nearly 409,000 apprehensions to less than 304,000. The Trump administration lauded this reduction by stating it undeniably proves the effectiveness of President Trump's commitment to securing our borders. More recently, the Trump administration has cited the number of border apprehensions in April 2018 to justify the administration's border security policies, including policies that have led to separating parents from their children. CBP notes that border apprehensions between and at ports of entry in April 2018 increased 223% compared to April 2017. Yet this figure obscures the number of border apprehensions so far in 2018. So far in 2018 remains on par with the number of apprehensions in the same period in 2017, and 6% below the same period in 2016. In addition, the number of apprehensions in April 2018 is not unusually high, only 5% above 2016 and 14% below 2014. So what that means is overall, the number of people attempting to enter the U.S. continues to trend downwards compared to all-time high levels in the early 2000s. So what is the real threat at our borders, and why are we addressing it with a policy that separates parents and children? In April of this year, the Trump administration announced that it would be separating children from parents who entered the country illegally, and in many cases, it has separated parents and children at the border. The Trump administration's decision to implement this zero-tolerance policy to criminally prosecute all migrants crossing the southwest border between ports of entry without authorization, including parents accompanied by their children, is, I'm sure you would agree, deeply troubling and has and will lead to the separation of thousands of families. As a country, we should not separate parents and children, in some cases parents and infants, in an attempt to deter people who are fleeing violence from legally seeking asylum or working for a better life in the U.S. Such a policy is short-sighted, cruel to families, harmful to children, and wholly contrary to American values. But don't just take it from me. Criticism about the Department of Justice policy comes from many corners, including those who promote the Christian value of family unity. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops noted that separating parents and children would, quote, be extremely detrimental to basic child welfare principles and ineffective to the goals of deterrence and safety. Reverend Sam Rodriguez, president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, stated that the practice could, quote, inadvertently incentivize a family to break apart. Others, like Eric Erickson, the conservative radio host and blogger, expressed concern about the potential abuse of children separated from their parents and urged the Trump administration to reconsider. Conservative columnists Jennifer Rubin and Michael Gerson characterized the policy as the undoing America's reputation as a decent country and a betrayal of American values, respectively. Experts from more than 200 national and state organizations involved in the fields of child welfare, juvenile justice, and child health, development, and safety pointed out that separating parents and children will compound the trauma many migrant children face and the time it would take them to recover and return to a trajectory of good health and normal development. In one recent case, the Department of Homeland Security separated a woman from her 7-year-old daughter for a period of 4 months before they were reunited. And just last week, the Washington Post and other outlets reported on the suicide of a man in custody who had been separated from his infant son. Once separated from their parents, the children are treated as unaccompanied alien children, the same as if they had arrived in the U.S. without an adult. They're placed in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Refugee Resettlement, and after a time placed with a sponsor while their cases are considered by immigration courts. HHS, Health and Human Services, recently disclosed that the Office of Refugee Resettlement had lost track of nearly 1,500 children placed with sponsors in the U.S., increasing our concern that implementing a policy to separate parents and children will have dire consequences for the children. The ORR data also showed that more than 700 children have already been separated from adults claiming to be their parents since October 2017, including more than 100 children under the age of 4. Finally, the threat of separating parents and children will not deter a parent whose children's lives are at risk, living every day in countries where gangs, drug cartels, and transnational criminal organizations prey upon families. The three neighboring Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador consistently rank among the most violent countries in the world. El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras still have the world's highest murder rates and significantly higher homicide rates than neighboring Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and Panama. Separating parents and children is unlikely to deter them from making the journey to the U.S. A policy that breaks up families is troubling and problematic both for the parents and children who will suffer great harm and the U.S. communities whose burden it will be to care for these displaced and broken children. Rather than pull families apart, we should aim to protect them. We should allow families to participate in existing alternatives to detention programs that are effective and less expensive than detaining them. Migrants who reach the southwest border and petition for asylum at a port of entry or between ports of entry are engaging in a process that is in accordance with U.S. laws and international treaties, primarily the Refugee Act of 1980 and the United Nations 1967 Protocol. The U.S. has a legal obligation to provide protection to those who are unable or unwilling to return to their home country due to past persecution or a well-founded fear of being persecuted in the future on account of, quote, race, religion, nationality, and/or membership in a particular social group or political opinion. The way we treat asylum seekers as a nation is proof that we can be a country of laws and grace. On the contrary, changing laws to make it more difficult for people to receive asylum would defy American values and extinguish a flame of hope for thousands of persecuted people, including women and children. We must allow asylum seekers fleeing violence and persecution to make their case under current law. Grants of asylum in the U.S. are not easy to obtain. Asylum seekers who tell a CBP officer or agent along the southwest border that they fear returning to their home country are referred for a credible fear interview and have the burden of proving that they have a significant possibility of establishing eligibility for asylum. If the asylum officer determines that the asylum seeker has a credible case, the asylum seeker is referred to an immigration court to prove their case before an immigration judge who makes the final decision. In 2016, an estimated 8,700 people were granted defense of asylum in the U.S., which governs the asylum process for migrants who arrived in the U.S. without authorization, including those who arrived as part of a caravan. That same year, 101,000 people made defense of asylum claims in the U.S. In effect, less than 1 in 10 were granted asylum. Under current asylum law, America's asylum process is a long-standing legal and humanitarian effort that is difficult and includes numerous safeguards against fraud. It provides an opportunity for asylum seekers with valid claims to find safe haven in the U.S. We must also recognize that Central American migrants traveling to the U.S. to request asylum are, for the most part, women and children fleeing persecution and violence at home. The overwhelming majority of these migrants pose no danger to the American people. And although the journey north is dangerous, the migrants see it as a better and safer option than staying in countries where they face threats from local gangs and other groups. As a nation, we must respond to these humanitarian situations with compassion and common sense, not by closing the policy door on people with valid asylum claims. Another topic in the news is the undocumented population, specifically what the term DACA. In June 2012, President Obama announced an executive order called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. The goal of DACA was to grant temporary protection from deportation for young people who had no legal status, who had been brought to the United States, usually by their parents. It was not an amnesty. It did not afford them permanent status or a pathway to citizenship. It merely allowed them to work, and merely is, among other things, it is very important. So I think merely is probably not the best word, but it allowed them to work and or study for a two-year period. And it deferred their deportation during that period, meaning DACA recipients would not be deported if they had DACA. To be eligible, they had to meet certain conditions, among them be in school or have finished high school, pass a background check, be able to show continuous presence in the United States, and pay $500 for the process. This executive order covered an estimated 1.2 million people, and some 700,000 to 800,000 took advantage of the program and were able to work and study. They were able to renew their DACA every 2 years until President Trump announced the ending of the program last September. There are still DACA recipients, and some were eligible to renew their DACA before October 5th of last year for a two-year period, which is what President Trump allowed for when he announced the ending of the program. And when President Trump announced the end of DACA, he gave Congress a six-month period to pass legislation to protect this group. In the interim, a court ruled that the Department of Homeland Security would have to accept renewals for current DACA holders for a two-year period, but did not allow for new applicants to apply. Congress failed to pass legislation that would protect these and other undocumented immigrants by March 5th. This group and so many others remain in limbo. Why should we care about this group? They are Americans in everything except on paper. They were raised here, educated here, and are contributing members of our society. They have not, quote, gotten into line to get papers because there's no line for them. Let me tell you about a couple of these folks. Deanna Hoyos is a DACA recipient, and she lives in Greenville, South Carolina. Deanna is a top science student in her high school, and she'd like to study health sciences and enter the medical profession either as a doctor or a nurse practitioner. When Deanna became aware of the shortage of healthcare workers in upstate South Carolina, she and her peers made a presentation to the Greenville hospital system on how DACA recipients could fill that gap. Christian Mendoza, who was born in Mexico and grew up in Austin, Texas, has a teaching degree and aspirations to become a police officer. He was part of a public safety program in high school and currently teaches and volunteers in Austin with the police as a communications liaison with the community. Because of DACA, he was able to work and get his degree, but because he has no permanent status, he is unable to become a police officer. Bernardo Castro of Utah came to the U.S. when he was an infant. He excelled in school, became an Eagle Scout, and because of DACA, he was able to go to Brigham Young University to study business administration, and he works for a mobile company. He has married another DACA recipient, and they have bought a home together. These are only three of many hundreds of thousands of such stories. Do we really want to lose this human capital and these contributing members of our communities? One argument in favor of a legal permanent status for these young people is that they were brought here through no fault of their own. But what of their parents? They knowingly, in most cases, broke a law. For the vast majority, there was no other way for them to come here and to make lives for themselves. And most were coming, as did all previous generations, to make a better life for themselves and their children. We need a permanent legal solution for Dreamers DACA recipients and their parents. There's a public safety element to this, too, but again, don't take my word for it. Art Acevedo is the chief of police of Houston, and he came to national prominence last year during the hurricane. Many of you might have seen him on the news. And Chief Acevedo says that failure to act on DACA will push many members of society into the dark and into isolation, further eroding the law enforcement community's ability to prevent, disrupt, and solve crime. And last but not least, words matter. It would help the debate enormously if we use the same lexicon or at least the same terminology correctly. And let me give you an example, the so-called sanctuary cities or jurisdictions. There's no single definition of a sanctuary city or jurisdiction. The term, which is borrowed from the church-centered sanctuary movement of the 1980s, is not defined by federal law and has been applied to a wide variety of cities, from those that have passed ordinances barring many types of cooperation with federal immigration authorities to those who have simply signed on to friend of the court legal briefs opposing Arizona's controversial SB 1070 law. There's no such thing as a law-free zone for immigration. Federal immigration laws are valid throughout the United States, including in sanctuary jurisdictions. Even where a particular city or law enforcement agency declines to honor a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement or ICE immigration detainer or limits involvement with federal immigration authorities, officers and agents from Customs and Border Protection and ICE can and do enforce federal immigration laws. Additionally, most of the jurisdictions the press and politicians are referring to are not actually sanctuary jurisdictions. Many cooperate with federal immigration officers, including honoring criminal detainers accompanied by a warrant or a court order, partnering with ICE in the 287G program, and providing notification of impending releases of undocumented immigrants with previous criminal convictions. So it is misleading and overly simplistic to conflate sanctuary jurisdictions with jurisdictions that refuse to honor federal immigration detainers. Similarly, adopting community policing principles is not the same thing as being a sanctuary jurisdiction. Over the past three decades, numerous state and local law enforcement agencies have implemented community policing strategies emphasizing trust building in immigrant populations. These policies, which recognize that state and local law enforcement need the trust of their communities, are tailored to ensure that immigrant victims and witnesses of crimes cooperate with police, leaving it to federal authorities to carry out immigration enforcement activities. These strategies are well established and effective. Lost in the discussion over sanctuary jurisdictions is that immigration enforcement has always been primarily a federal responsibility. As the U.S. Supreme Court recently affirmed in Arizona versus U.S., the case striking down much of SB 1070, the federal government possesses broad, undoubted power over the subject of immigration. At the same time, federalism principles under the U.S. Constitution limit what Congress can do to mandate that state and local law enforcement carry out federal immigration priorities and programs. Constitutional restrictions prevent the federal government from attempting to commandeer state governments into directly carrying out federal regulatory programs. With genuine concerns about local law enforcement being asked to enforce federal immigration law and the effects that it has on community safety, we must be careful not to use a sweeping definition that hurts community policing and community safety. After all, only a handful of jurisdictions call themselves sanctuaries in the first place.
No matter the language, cities are trying to do what is best and safest for all of their residents in the long run. Rather than use sanctuary city as both a catch-all and a scapegoat, we need to make a good faith effort to clarify immigration enforcement responsibilities, and we call on Congress to do that. Rather than a political firestorm in the wake of a tragedy, we need cooperation that demonizes no one and at the same time makes all of us safer. As I close today, I would urge all of us to keep in mind that while we are a country of laws, we can apply those laws with wisdom, compassion, discretion, and we can modify and update those laws without violating our values as a nation. I would also encourage us to lower the tone of the debate, to assume good faith as we work together to build and protect this country that has long benefited from welcoming strangers to its shores. Thank you very much.
Come on up, Matt.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Matthew O'Brien. My background is a tad wee bit different than our previous speaker. I spent the majority of my career working directly in immigration enforcement for the prior Immigration and Naturalization Service, as well as for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and I ended my career with the government as the Chief of the National Security Division at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. After my service with INS and prior to returning to the government with ICE, I actually spent about 6 or 7 years as an immigration attorney where I represented people in all manner of immigration proceedings. So I have seen this issue from both sides. We're in an interesting time because immigration is something that has largely been ignored as a policy matter. There's been confusion over whether it constitutes domestic policy, whether it constitutes foreign policy, or whether it's some sort of a hybrid. But largely, it's been one of those things that crops up in the news when some kind of a controversial issue occurs, but is otherwise ignored. President Trump's presidential campaign changed that completely. It became the primary issue in the American political realm. And we have the first president in approximately 50 years who has taken immigration seriously. And that's a good thing. And the reason for that is illegal aliens, illegal migration, cost us about $116 billion, with a B, per year in the United States. By the Department of Homeland Security's own admission, less than half of the border is currently under control. Only about 700 miles of the border is secured by a physical barrier, and that barrier is falling apart. Congress implemented the Secure Fence Act over 2 decades ago, and because of all sorts of delays and budgetary issues, the fence that was mandated under that act has never been completed. And the sections of it that were never completed according to the specifications that Congress requested. So, we're in a situation where if we take a look at what's going on at the border, it's very popular for people in the media to talk about the nature of the threat and quote reductions in apprehensions at the border. Well, the problem is we don't know who we didn't apprehend, and that's the more alarming feature. Reductions in apprehensions are usually an indication that our talk about enforcing immigration laws has had an effect, and people who are thinking about attempting to cross the border have decided not to do it. The fact is, the people who do cross the border undetected, we don't know about, and we don't know how many of them are here. Now, post September 11th, that is a major concern because the fact is terrorists are very aware of the fact that our border is porous and they have an incentive to exploit that in order to gain entry into the United States. We currently think that there are about 12.5 million illegal aliens in the United States. Of course, it's virtually impossible to tell how many are here because we don't know. They're illegal, they haven't checked in with anyone, and their purpose is to evade detection, thereby circumventing the immigration laws and being able to stay in the United States. That's a problem in a number of different regards. There's the concern about terrorism. But we also have a lot of other things that go on along the border which are dangerous to the United States and which create significant law enforcement and public safety problems. There is gun smuggling. There's drug smuggling. There's people smuggling. All of that is being driven by the fact that some of our nearby neighbors have an economic standard that is lower than that of the United States, but also by the fact that Mexico is, in essence, a failed state. Venezuela is a failed state. Nicaragua is well on its way to being a failed state, and a number of other states in the region are in a similarly bad condition. So what does that mean? The numbers are going to start growing, inevitably, of people who are coming here. So the claim that the threat on the border is much reduced and we don't need to worry about it is not a logical assumption. It's sort of like saying, well, we've successfully reduced disease, so we don't need doctors anymore. Fact is that even when we're well, we need doctors in order to keep from getting sick. Now, another thing to take into account with immigration is it's a law enforcement issue. It is not a social services issue. And a lot of the hysteria connected with the separation of children and parents at the border is just an attempt to confuse a debate that should be governed by facts by shifting the focus to feelings. When people are apprehended at the Border Patrol or ICE or whoever happens to be apprehending them, because frequently it involves the Bureau of Land Management or other federal agencies that operate along the border, they have no idea who these people are. And the fact is that many people commit their children to the care of immigrant smugglers in order to get them into the United States. So one of the reasons that they're separated, and they have been for quite some time, is in order to establish whether this person is actually a family member and somebody who has the best interest of the child at heart. Now, that indicates the overall nature of the problem at the border. People aren't interested in telling the truth to the border authorities. They're interested in getting into the United States, which means there's a very high level of fraud in a lot of immigration applications. There's no way to vet a lot of these people because they come from places that aren't like the United States. Vetting is a fancy word fancy way of talking about background checks. And background checks are possible in the United States because we all have an established identity. We have mortgages, we have bank accounts, we have debit cards, we have automobile registrations. All of those things create a pattern in our lives that is accessible to law enforcement or other entities that want to check out whether we are who we say we are and whether we've been up to the things that we claim. But the fact is, many other cultures don't operate that way. And very frequently, when you have people who are refugees or asylees, they're coming from states where all of the mechanisms for running daily civic life have fallen apart. So even if you were to ask their country for information, you can't get it. So that's the situation with the border and with illegal immigration. Let's take a look at legal migration. Currently, our system is about 70% family-based and 30% employment-based. Family-based means that in order to immigrate to the United States, you have to have a qualifying relative who's already here, who then files a petition on your behalf. That means that immigrants are a self-selecting pool. They're not being chosen directly by the United States. Broadly speaking, once someone establishes a chain, more people connected to that chain are going to come, which means that the United States doesn't have any control at the current time over what countries people are coming from and the numbers in which they come, other than the annual cap that's placed on admissions to the United States, which largely becomes meaningless because of all the exceptions that were written into it. On the other hand, only 30% of the people who are admitted to the United States are admitted on the basis of employment. And even in that situation, it's not a skills-based or merit-based immigration system. It's U.S. employers asking for people. Frequently, U.S. employers request employees from overseas because those employees are willing to work for less money than people in the United States. This certainly helps expand profits for these companies, but what it does is it undercuts the wage market for American workers. So you have people being replaced by workers from overseas. The most prominent instance of that was the case with Disney, where the Disney Corporation was hiring tech employees on H-1B visas and then asking them to the American workers that they were replacing to train their replacements. FAIR has represented those people in a suit. That suit was originally dismissed. However, FAIR just won a recent victory in the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, allowing the case to proceed once again. Now, the fact is, we are a sovereign country. We have a right, and an unfettered right at that, to determine who may come into the United States. Here in the U.S., that's an issue of law. When we refuse to obey those laws, or when we start poking holes in them to the point where they become meaningless, what we're essentially doing is delegating our sovereignty to people who are outside of the United States. Well, no country that does that will last very long. Right now, we have a falling birth rate, but a growing population. About 70% of that population growth is being driven by immigration to the United States. Now, if you think of a glass of wine, you have a glass of red wine, you start adding water to it. At some point, you replace enough of the wine with water, there's no longer any wine there to speak of, it's just simply a glass of water. And that certainly is what can happen when you have massive amounts of immigration without any requirement that people assimilate to the host culture. Now, Peter Brimlow, who wrote Alien Nation, which I highly recommend, it's one of the most insightful books on the history of U.S. immigration ever written, calls the way that the U.S. system used to work the role of the refreshing pause. We had fluctuations driven largely by the need for labor or for expansion. Then there were large periods of 10, 15, 20, 30, sometimes 40 years where we didn't have a large amount of immigration. And what that did is it allowed people to become acclimated to the United States. Because it's all well and good to talk about the United States as a nation of immigrants, but if you stop and think about that, how can you have a nation composed of immigrants? Because if you have a nation, at some point, don't people have to stop identifying as immigrants and start identifying as Americans in order for us to maintain any kind of social, civic, and political unity? Now, if we look at amnesty and DACA, DACA is deferred action for childhood arrivals. Deferred action is a discretionary authority that exists in immigration law for a specific purpose. It is for the administrative convenience of the government, and it is to allow the government to refrain from deporting people who are acknowledged to be deportable from the United States in order to conduct diplomacy. It was frequently used during the Cold War to keep from deporting dissidents. It's used when people are going to be witnesses in cases and testify, and it's used by the intelligence community when people are willing to become cooperators. It's not a license for the President of the United States to usurp the function of Congress and grant a temporary amnesty on a blanket basis to everyone who he wants to remain in the country. And the fact is, amnesty is simply rewarding bad behavior. And anyone who has been a parent, a law enforcement professional, a teacher, a corrections officer knows that rewarding bad behavior just begets more bad behavior. And in fact, the situation that we're currently in, immigration-wise, is directly attributable to the 1986 amnesty. After the 1986 amnesty was put in place, it triggered a flurry of illegal aliens entering the United States so that they could be here for the next amnesty. Now, that's evidenced in a large measure by the fact that the estimated illegal alien population in 1986, shortly before the amnesty took effect, was roughly 3.2 million. There are now roughly 12.5 million illegal aliens in the United States. So, the overuse of discretionary power really runs a possibility of generating a constitutional crisis in the United States because we have three branches of government. And the function of the executive branch of government is to enforce the laws of the United States as written. It is not the province of the executive branch to determine what parts of the law should be enforced and shouldn't, or how the law should be enforced. It is to enforce the laws as Congress wrote them within the bounds of common sense and practicality. Well, what we have with immigration, which we wouldn't accept with any other aspect of our law, is we are allowing law enforcement agencies, INS, Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection, to tell the potential violators what aspects of the law they're going to enforce and which ones they aren't. Now, can any of you conceive of the police chief of the city of New York telling everyone, this is the list of crimes that we are not going to enforce this month? And yet that's exactly what we do with immigration. Much of what is currently being reviled as draconian and as inappropriate and against American values is simply the Trump administration using authorities that previously existed and that were regularly used by the government, but that successive administrations have opted not to use in order to curry favor with political constituencies. So that puts us in a position where we have to ask ourselves, why don't we want to do another amnesty? Because if we do, it's simply going to attract more people waiting for the next amnesty. And a lot of the arguments in favor of doing this aren't really well supported. The human capital argument is problematic. The DACA recipients have been portrayed as all being valedictorians and military heroes and potential congressional honor winners and all of these things. But in fact, less than 1% of them served in the military. Only about 22% of them earned a college degree. They have a very high high school dropout rate, and about 10 to 15% of the applications received were received from people that had disqualifying felony convictions. That's a problem. This is not the segment of society that was represented to the American public as being rewarded for their contributions to the United States. The two industries in which most of them work are construction and food services. These are not people who are contributing to the high-tech economy. So we have to ask ourselves, are we really in a position with a porous border facing threats from terrorism all over the world, and the bulk of these people coming from Mexico and other places in Latin America that are more and more presenting a threat to the United States in the form of crime, political instability, and so on and so forth, do we really want to reward them and set ourselves back when we haven't even managed to secure the border in the first place? Now, that brings us to the issue of sanctuary cities. Prior to the Trump campaign, how many people here had heard of a sanctuary city? A few. Now, they existed, and it was an issue. However, since the Trump campaign began, the number of sanctuary cities in the United States has more than doubled. Now, what is a sanctuary city? Well, it's a fancy way of saying a jurisdiction that has decided that we're just not going to comply with federal law because we don't like it. And the fact is that in the United States v. Arizona case that was referred to previously, the holding actually was that immigration is a preempted federal field, meaning that the states don't have the option to legislate on immigration. It belongs to the federal government. And that was the basis for the federal government telling Arizona, you can't go forward with this law. Well, if that's true, then none of these sanctuary cities have any business being involved in immigration or telling the federal government that they're not going to comply with federal law, because they don't have any authority whatsoever to enact any of those types of regulations. And the fact is, what they're doing has a legal name. It's called obstacle preemption. And that is when a state or local jurisdiction specifically erects a legal obstacle to the enforcement of a legitimate federal law. That's what's going on. It's a similar situation with the detainers. These have largely been represented in the media as being a Fourth Amendment civil rights issue. They're not. The fact is, you can't get a warrant in order to arrest someone who is an illegal alien unless you're charging them with a crime, because there's no statutory authority upon which a judge can issue that warrant. The authority for civil arrests, for removal of people, comes from the statute, the Immigration and Nationality Act, which directly confers the power on the Department of Homeland Security. So the Department of Homeland Security only issues detainers for people who they are certain are unlawfully present in the United States, and it's a simple request to transfer someone from one law enforcement agency to another. This is done all the time in other contexts. It's done all the time between states. This whole argument that this is somehow some kind of a terrible, un-American, inappropriate, unconstitutional thing that's being done to people who are being arrested for violating the immigration laws is just completely inaccurate. As a matter of fact, the entire time that I spent with ICE, I wrote and filed thousands of detainers, and we never had a problem with anyone honoring them. So that's a new development. So where does this leave us? Well, the fact is, we need to secure our borders. We have a huge problem. We have people pouring into the United States. They're costing taxpayers a crazy amount of money. And while not all immigrants are bad, I come from a family of immigrants. You can tell by my last name. A significant portion of my family is from Ireland. I also grew up with my grandfather's family, who were all from Sweden, and I can still remember as a child them speaking Swedish and me having absolutely no idea what they were saying, getting very frustrated when no one would teach me Swedish. Of course, the reason they didn't want to teach me Swedish is they said, we're Americans now. We do this to remember the old times, but you were born here in the United States. You need to speak English. And of course, I can remember even at 6 or 7 years old going, but I do. I would like to learn Swedish. Nonetheless, my wife is the child of a German Holocaust survivor. She was actually born in the United States. Her mother married an American GI. Almost immediately after she was born, they moved back to Germany. And so for the first 6 or 7 years of her life, she spoke German and was essentially raised as a German. It's funny because she claims to have forgotten German every time we go to an embassy event in D.C. at any one of the Scandinavian embassies or the Swiss or the German embassy. Everyone assumes that she's from there and begins speaking to her in what she affectionately refers to as nerney nerney because she doesn't have any idea what they're saying. So the fact is, fair, and a lot of people who are on the restrictionist, although I don't like that name, side of this issue, who want to see immigration appropriately controlled, are not immigrant haters, and they're not racists. And the equating immigration with racism is silly because immigrants aren't a race. They come from all over the world. So what do we want to do? Well, what we want to do is we want to put in place procedures that make immigration policies work for the American public. Goes back to ancient Greek and Roman philosophers. The first duty of government is to protect the citizens. Otherwise, we don't need a government. That's what it exists for. And the American government, at least where immigration is concerned, hasn't been doing a very good job of that. It's been putting the needs of immigrants ahead of the needs of United States citizens. So one of the first things that we need to do is start turning off the magnets. Now, an easy way that we could do that, there's a system called E-Verify that's currently in place that allows employers to log on to the internet and verify whether an individual is authorized to work in the United States. This is not mandatory for all employers in the U.S. FAIR doesn't understand why. It's illogical. That, in and of itself, would turn off one of the most significant magnets and would probably eliminate up to 90% of the economically based immigration to the United States. Now, the other thing that we need to do is take a serious look at the way we accord asylum and refugee status to people who are asking for it. A Department of State study found that about 70% of the applications that the Department of State was involved in either adjudicating for refugees or providing information to Citizenship and Immigration Services in support of those applications turned out to be fraudulent. That jives with my experience. I ran the organization within USCIS that looks for fraud in these applications. And the fact is that a number of internal reports in the federal government that have been leaked to the press found fraud rates overall as high as 33%. So that's roughly a third of the applications that are being submitted are ones that were obviously fraudulent. We need to stop accepting fraudulent applications, and we need to start prosecuting people when they commit demonstrable fraud. Otherwise, they're going to keep doing it. Now, I understand why someone who is trying to get out of Venezuela would be tempted to perpetrate fraud to come to the United States. However, the argument that people are left with no other choice is an unfortunate one, because as human beings, and as people who largely come from the Judeo-Christian tradition, we're compassionate. We want to observe the golden rule. The problem is when you start reducing that to its logical ends, it tends to fall apart. We all lock our doors at night. We do that not because we hate the world outside, we do it because we love the people inside. And the fact is that if you go home tonight and you find some guy you don't know in your basement, you're probably not going to invite him to stay with your family, offer to pay for college, and give him a job. You're going to call 911 and ask him to be removed. And the fact is that if your neighbors referred to him as an undocumented resident of your home, you probably would find that a little bit bizarre. So the notion that people who are illegally present in the United States because they haven't gotten in the line yet because there is no line is an absolutely silly one. We have laws to regulate our borders. And the fact is, it's not up to people who are not citizens of this country to make a unilateral decision that they want to be here. And my fellow speaker referenced an individual who wanted to be a police officer but couldn't. Well, if you're a United States citizen who is applying for a job as a police officer and you have a misdemeanor theft conviction, you're not going to get a job as a police officer. I grew up in a family full of Irish cops in Boston. I know this for a fact. The background check process is fairly thorough. How can we make a legitimate argument in the United States, a nation of laws, that we should be making people who are trespassers in the United States police officers and charging them with enforcing our own laws when they began their relationship with the United States by violating them? Which brings me to the second thing that we have to do. We have to secure the border. Now, we need to do that by a combination of technology, physical barriers, and the assignment of personnel to the border. 16,000 Border Patrol agents sounds like a lot, but those are people who are working in shifts defending 2,500 miles of border, which is largely unsecured. Much of it is remote and difficult to police. They're also up against complicated situations that even people who work in local law enforcement don't understand. There's been 5 Border Patrol helicopters that were crashed by people throwing rocks at them since the late 1970s. And there is a tendency of people to portray the Border Patrol as being some kind of jackbooted thugs, when in fact they do one of the most dangerous and unrecognized law enforcement jobs in the United States. There was a Border Patrol agent shot just within the last few days while patrolling the outer limits of a farm, a ranch, that was along the border. So what we have to do is take a look at the way we are policing the border. Prior to September 11th and the terrorist attacks, we honestly didn't pay that much attention to it. We wanted to put up a facade of enforcing our borders and put up a deterrent. Well, now we have to take a multi-phased approach. We have to send a clear message that you are not going to be tolerated if you come here illegally. You're not going to be tolerated if you overstay your visa and stay here illegally. We have to invest in technology. We're now at a point where we can use drones and other appropriate technology to monitor the border. But the problem with that is that it makes us reactive. When you catch someone on a sensor or a drone coming over the border, you then have to send someone out, unless you have somebody very nearby, to catch them. And the advantage of a physical barrier is it's going to deter most people who are interested in getting across it if it is difficult enough to pass. You will always have drug smugglers and gun runners and terrorists trying to go over, under, or around. But the fact is, look at the way that we put walls around prisons. Now, America's not a prison. We don't want to keep people in. But the fact is, walls are effective. We build fences around our property. We build fences around other areas that we want to keep secure, like military bases, so on and so forth. It's absolutely absurd that we would leave our border, particularly with the South, where so many states are in disarray, completely unprotected. And the northern border is another issue altogether, because Canada has largely had very lax asylum policies and very lax what's called transit without visa policies, where they allow people to come into Canada, and if you say, I have no intention of staying, I'm making my way elsewhere, you're very frequently allowed to stay in Canada for a short period of time, and then of course a lot of the people simply walk over the border. Now, I went to law school in Maine. I've spent a lot of time fishing, hunting, skiing, and other things, snowshoeing up in the wilds of Maine. And the border up there beggars belief. Because you'll be walking along a trail and all of a sudden you'll see a sign that says American-Canadian border, do not enter, and there's an orange cone. And there's a note with a number that you call to try and get one of the immigration people who's on call, or directions to where the nearest Border Patrol post is so that you can be admitted into the United States or Canada. Needless to say, this doesn't work very well, and we've had a number of documented instances of people with nefarious intentions coming into the United States over the Canadian border. Finally, we need to deport the violators. We can't be rewarding people who violate our immigration laws and hope that they're ever going to be useful or consistent. The fact is, it's a crime to improperly enter the United States. It's also a civil violation to improperly enter the United States, and it's a civil violation to overstay your visa. That's a civil administrative jurisdiction. It's an incident of sovereignty. It's not a complicated process legally for people to be removed from the United States. We're in a position now where we give people process that is not actually due, and we do it to the exclusion of our authorities as a sovereign country, and we do it in a way that sometimes prejudices U.S. citizens because people are put back into communities when they shouldn't be here. Every crime that's committed by an illegal alien is by definition a preventable crime because that person shouldn't have been here in the first place. So, we don't need to stop being a nation of immigrants if one prefers that moniker. What we do need to do is start being a responsible nation with defined borders so that we can say to people who are coming here, this is what's expected for you to get in, this is what's expected once you are here, and we will not tolerate violations. Thank you.
We'll now start the question and answer period. If you have a question, raise your hand. I would urge that people with questions of Kathleen start, because she has to leave early today to catch the train back to D.C.
I wanted, before you have to leave, Ms. Farrell, so your presentation, you were arguing effectively, I thought, that illegal entry on the southern border was not much of an issue. You talked about how
apprehensions had dropped, yes.
Yeah, you said apprehensions had dropped, so forth and so on. I kind of wondered why they dropped so much. But on the other hand, Mr. O'Brien is, I guess, arguing completely the opposite, that the reason they're small numbers is that so much of the border, they don't even know what's going on. So could you two please help me to understand?
I think part of my argument is that we've got to, that it's much more effective, and we're not saying at all that we shouldn't fortify the border. We're saying that that it has to be, and you know, you mentioned it too, it's a combination of technology, personnel, physical and natural barriers. I said that very specifically. And that we should fortify personnel at ports of entry, where there's an awful lot of activity and a lot of people pass through there. That's really the main point that I'm making. So,
well, the point I was trying to make is you're going to see, just because conditions in immigration tend to be driven by two factors. There's push factors and pull factors. Now, pull factors are jobs, other things that may attract people to the United States, like the potential of an amnesty, the desire to be in a safe, stable territory. The push factors tend to be things that are going on external to the United States, natural disasters, coups, changes in political regimes that happen not as a coup under an election but aren't popular, things of that nature. But the fact is, all of those things will make the numbers go up and down. But you always have a number of people that are getting over an unfortified, unsecured border that you never know about. And those are the people that typically are the problem, because they're the ones that make their way to the interior of the U.S. and you have absolutely no idea. And one final point, I think the message that we send is important. Australia had a huge problem with people coming from South Asia, Afghanistan, and a number of other countries in that sort of broadly South Asian region who were getting onto boats and going to Australia. Australia started a newspaper ad campaign in the languages all those people spoke in their countries that said, don't come to Australia illegally, you will not be let in. The first month that the ads were posted, they had a 92% reduction in the number of people attempting to come to Australia. So I think that President Trump's rhetoric about immigration enforcement, even prior to his election, caused a lot of people to stop coming here. Then the possibility of a DACA deal began to raise the numbers. Then the DACA deal falling apart and the fact that there might be no amnesty and Trump saying, I'm going to prosecute anyone who enters illegally, and starting to do that, then decrease the numbers. So you'll see those things go up and down, but they're not necessarily a measure of how big the threat is or even how well things are working.
Back in the back row.
Excellent program. Okay, thanks. Excellent program. Thank you. We often talk about the illegals, and the onus of criticism usually is on the many people who came here and violated a law, really. So, however, isn't it true that we're all illegals, all of us, that we hired for our lawn mowing, our roofing, our companies hired people to pick the lettuce, pick the cotton, to do so many other things. In other words, as you said, there's a pull factor that's been in operation for decades. And businesses and everybody else kind of winked and smiled and went along with it. And so of these 12.5 million people in the country, many of them, we know them personally. We know them as fine people, hardworking people. Their children speak English. They've grown up to love this country. And yet we're treating them as criminals, in a sense, just by the language we use, which is illegal. Can't we recognize that all of us have been part of this program? My question is really addressed at the 12.5 million people who came here in a way that was wide open, really. I'm not talking about securing the borders and all those other questions, which are legitimate. But on this question, it seems like a little more understanding is useful. But please address that, if you will.
So I think there's a bunch of ways to look at that. And one is, I wouldn't say we're all illegals. You know, I think that we aren't. No, I would not say that. I would say, and the term illegals isn't, you know, a human being's not illegal, but not everybody is hiring people without papers. But there is a need that's not being filled by Americans. There is a workforce shortage, and it's going to get worse. And you know, we basically, I mean, Dr. Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention is fond of saying we have two signs at the border: one that says "Help Wanted," and the other that says that "Keep Out." We, as a society, as a community, and as a country, we have to make a decision about who we want in. I mean, I started by saying we're a sovereign nation. We have a right to decide who comes and goes. The reality that I'm trying to address when I talk about the undocumented is we have, you know, an estimated 12 million people without papers, and we're depending on them. Should they all stay? Perhaps not. Are there accommodations to be made? I would think there are.
As far as the terminology goes, I think undocumented is a term that started to arise in the 60s as a deliberate attempt to recast the debate. Undocumented is what my vehicle is when I don't register it. Of course, the state of Virginia will then arrest me for felony if they catch me driving an unregistered, uninsured vehicle. The term used in the Constitution, which has consistently been used in Anglo-American common law for all of its history, going back to the Domesday Book and before, for a person who is not a citizen is an alien. Well, lawyers, just like everyone else, can track terms, and so the correct term for someone who is not in the United States lawfully is someone who is an illegal alien. And, you know, references to things like papers imply that you can go to some place that's like the Registry of Motor Vehicles, the DMV, and sign up. But that's not the way our immigration system works. Now, the problem that you speak of is one that I mentioned. For a long time, the political leaders in the United States have been selectively enforcing the immigration laws because they want to pander to particular political constituencies. Many of those are in agriculture and industries like construction, where people are artificially increasing their profits. But I guess the thing is, do we want to continue doing that? Because that's exploitation of people, and we don't approve of that. I mean, forced peonage is directly in the Constitution. We had a 4-year war over people doing uncompensated or low compensated labor in the United States. It's why we don't have indentured servitude anymore. So, were there businesses and other people that were complicit in this? Sure. But the fact that people violate the law is not an argument that we shouldn't have the law. We can erase the murder rate in the United States by decriminalizing homicide.
Yeah. I have always thought there was a simple solution to this. So I like your comment on it. I'm a tax preparer. I have thought that if every employer had to report a particular tax ID, some kind of number relative to an employee, their name, and you know, like a social security number, which we use, but in the case of illegals, it would be some other number. As a matter of fact, there's actually an IRS number called TIN.
A tax ID, yeah.
That I'm shocked if there are ways to file a tax return when you don't have a Social Security number. But anyway, so if we require employers, in order to get a deduction on their cost of labor, I think it would solve it in a New York minute. And it takes a lot of computer power. If we'd given, Congress would give the IRS enough money to have really, really good computers, you know, we could run this. So what's, I never see my argument discussed, though. So what do you two think about
that? So I think there's another part to that argument, which is if these people are working and they don't have, you know, a number, a Social Security number, an ITIN, I mean, doesn't that tell us also that there is a need for those people? I mean, I think more that, yes, we should have, people should be able, should identify themselves in order to pay taxes, but we clearly need these people.
The employer making a deduction for the labor costs he has spent to that employee.
The employers are not required to match their deductions for payroll costs to a number. There's a couple of
problems.
Well, it's a problem. However, I'm not sure if that would necessarily solve the problem because there's a couple of aspects to this. Employers, in order to do withholding, actually do have to have a number associated with each employee. Now, there's a significant amount of fraud that goes on, and you have people using fake Social Security numbers and stolen Social Security numbers. The Internal Revenue Service has publicly stated that its job is not to enforce the immigration laws, it's to collect taxes. So what happens is, if you're an illegal alien working unlawfully in the United States, and you want to give an employer the impression that you're somewhat legitimate, then you get a hold of a number that for whatever reason works for the withholding. Then you get an individual tax ID number, which are made available to people regardless of citizenship. Their primary purpose was to allow foreign investors to file taxes. You then file your tax return using the ITIN and tell the IRS that the withholding based on your W-2 was done with this number. The IRS does not prosecute you for the fraud involved, and it processes your tax return. So there's a couple of complex aspects to this. Number one.
I don't want to be rude to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I have a train to catch. I miscalculated my time here. I just really thank you very, very much for listening to both of us today. And I will send around my email, and Matt can send his. And any questions you have, please send us a note. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Very nice to meet you.
Yes. In the late 70s through the 80s, I adopted 4 children from another nation. So I was 12 years in that situation between the social services agencies and immigration and naturalization. It probably could have been done in 3 years, but for the incompetence of both organizations. 2 of the children we adopted while we were in New York City, and one of the slaps was, when you went to the police station to get your fingerprints, the sign said, fingerprints, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 10 to 12. Non-criminals, $10. So if you were a criminal, you got them for free, but if you were a taxpayer, you had to pay the $10. And that's pretty much how the system worked. But the end result was a wonderful, wonderful experience, and I would go through all the bureaucracy, all the paperwork, all the interviews again for the same purpose. And between the paperwork or the interviews, et cetera, those kind of fences, I probably would rather go through the physical fence than the fences I had to get through to bring those 4 children into the country. So obviously there were plenty of regulations and laws. Why can't we just enforce the regulations and laws today?
That's exactly what we should be doing. There's more than adequate authority on the books to enforce immigration and to secure the borders. But if you look at what's happening, that's exactly what the president did. And he's been challenged at every turn with, quite frankly, what amount to bogus legal claims. I mean, Section 1182F of 8 United States Code specifically gave the president the authority to implement a temporary travel moratorium. I don't like the word ban. In order to reevaluate the national security situation. The statutory authority that was given by Congress was enormously broad. It's been used by every president in the last 60 years in responding to a variety of different situations. Somehow when President Trump did it, it was a problem for the ACLU, and activist judges in the Ninth Circuit imposed all these barriers. And I think, you know, one of the questions we have to be asking that comes up with this is, since when can a federal district court impose a nationwide injunction? I mean, we had a situation where the president made a national security choice, which is, according to about 150 years of precedent, not subject to regulation by the courts and not even the business of the courts. And yet you had courts in Hawaii and California and the state of Washington putting up injunctions telling the president he couldn't exercise a plenary power that's confided directly to him by the Constitution. So I think your point is well taken. There's plenty of regulations. The solution to this isn't more regulation. It's to follow the regulations we have and to expect our executive branch to act as the executive branch and not try and supplant Congress's authority.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, okay.
One of the thoughts that long ago crossed my mind, and Ms. Farrell talked to this, you know, these people come and quote, they want a better life. But for me, yeah, so do I, so I don't think that sets them apart. But why not have, and you touched on it a little bit, and this person did also relating to using TIN, but issue passes that are, say, temporary work passes, because we do need certain kinds of labor that is just not being filled within our own ranks, and there's no denying that. But if you set up a system where these people, before they ever cross the border, if they got ID cards of some kind that were linked into a national network, so that if suppose they wanted to come here to work in Charlottesville, they could go down to the police department, be validated, and that alone would enable them to go out and get a job in the food industry or anything else. But likewise, the other side of that coin is a lot of times the meatpacking industry, for example, in the Midwest, they hire a lot of people that are undocumented and so forth. So my question is, that's fine. You catch them at it, then you go back and you fine the company brutally to make up for the pay these people were not getting paid. So you remove that incentive. What can the company do? Well, we'll go out of business. Well, okay, that's tough luck. You got into it and doing it illegally, so you lose your business. Boo-hoo.
Well, there's a couple of issues that tend to get conflated in these discussions. So first of all, we do have a fairly extensive system. It's not open for all people to work, but a fairly extensive system of what are called non-immigrant visas that allow people to come here temporarily to work. We have the H-2A program, which covers agricultural workers, the H-2B program, which covers seasonal employees, the H-1B program, which covers any kind of college-educated specialty occupation. And those things bring in very large numbers of people. The impetus for hiring people unlawfully usually is not a shortage of labor. It's the desire of the employer to pay something less than the market wage. And so what you have is an employer exploiting somebody because they're here unlawfully, and you have that employer undercutting the market wage. And I agree with you completely. We need much more worksite enforcement. Worksite enforcement hadn't been done for the last 30 years. The Trump administration has begun doing it. And, of course, it had all kinds of howls and cries that, oh, my God, the ICE is going in there and arresting all these illegal aliens. Well, yes, of course, because they're illegal aliens and they don't have any authorization to work. That's what ICE does. So, you know, it's one of those things where we want to make sure we don't conflate issues. And, you know, do we need more temporary worker type programs? Well, we had a guest worker program for agriculture in the 60s, and it just didn't work because there was very high employment in Mexico at the time, and people didn't want to come here. So those are complicated issues, and there are no easy solutions. But I agree with you, the first step that we need to do before we consider what kind of programs we need is enforce the current restrictions that we have against employers. Problem is that the employers have a very big lobby. The Vidalia onion growers a number of years back were raided by the Border Patrol, and they said, well, we won't be able to bring in the harvest. And they went through the big ag lobbying organization in Washington, D.C., and the Border Patrol essentially said, well, we'll let these people stay until the harvest is completed. And nobody fined any of the agricultural employers. So you point out probably the most significant problem in terms of illegal migration and labor.
One of the things we always hear is people say, go back and do it legally from wherever you come from. And the problem is, of course, that doing it legally puts you in that waiting line. And I know from Philippines, I think it's well over 10 years once you have processed all the paperwork that you're just waiting to get through the system. I never hear people who talk about beefing up workers at the border talk about increasing workers in the office to process paperwork. Wouldn't that help facilitate the process?
Yes and no. Part of the reason for those backups are the way that the annual cap system works. So there's only a certain number of visas that are available in each of these classifications, which is done by a complicated formula that Congress set when they implemented the most current incarnation of the Immigration and Nationality Act. So it's not processing backlogs. It's a combination of processing backlogs, which the creation of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services was supposed to help eliminate and to a certain extent did. But it's a combination of those with the attempt to limit the number of people coming here via a cap that first of all is hard to figure out. There's like one guy at the Department of State with a graphing calculator who knows how to do it. And on top of that, it doesn't work all that effectively because it's riddled with all kinds of different exceptions and people who are exempt from the cap.
I think sometimes we kind of confuse all immigration questions. For instance, for 9/11, as far as I know, those were I-20s to profit-making colleges. That's what caused 9/11, not our southern border. And then the other thing is, I think that's enough. Maybe I'll just stop with that one, because I work with international students, and we had to check each week to be sure they were there. That was not done during 9/11.
Well, the reason it wasn't
had to do with the Mexican border.
The reason it wasn't done was because the federal government was essentially ignoring all of that. I was the immigration attorney for Suffolk University in Boston and oversaw their international student program. I left there to move to New York City and take a job with a private law firm about a year before the September 11th attacks happened. So they were not all on I-20s. Some of them were here on F student visas, for which you need an I-20 as the precursor. Some of them were here on tourist visas, and there were a couple who were here on other visas like H-1B visas. So the cause of September 11th was an overall lack of following the Immigration and Nationality Act, an overall laxity of enforcement. However, the southern border has since morphed with the growth of radical Islamic terrorism in the Middle East, because the terrorists aren't stupid, and they have figured out that it's very easy to get into Mexico. It's even easier to get into places like Guatemala and Nicaragua that are falling apart. And then they simply hire someone to take them to the border, or they walk, and they cross the southern border. And we know for a fact that there have been terrorists who have done this. Some of them have been arrested and prosecuted on terrorism charges. There are other people who the federal government suspects are here, but they haven't been able to locate. E-Verify works extremely well. It is an online portal to a government system which allows record checks of 64 different federal, state, and local databases with information relevant to people's work authorization. And what it does is it allows the employer to go input an individual's name, birth date, and other identifying information. And then it comes back with what's called a tentative non-confirmation. If you receive a tentative non-confirmation, you have 8 federal working days to contact the Department of Homeland Security or go to the Social Security Administration in order to contest that if you have proof that you are able to work. If you don't, then what happens is you're listed as a hard non-confirmation and you're not eligible to work. Now, it has some interesting features because it insulates the employer from dismissing someone for legal liability for dismissing someone who the federal government has said is not authorized to work. So for that reason alone, given the kind of litigious society that we live in and the way that labor law has developed, it should be attractive to employers because if you've done this correctly and the person turns out to be unlawfully present, you're not on the hook for hiring them, and you can terminate them without any liability under state, federal, or local law.
We don't have enough time for an additional question, so let's thank again Matt O'Brien for being here.
Thank you.